Welcome to Health and Happiness, a weekly program of KGVM 95.9 FM and KGVM.org. Also, we are rebroadcast on Thursday mornings. We thank the Public Education Committee of the Montana Psychological Association for supporting our program, which is mostly about mental health, but is about health in general today, especially about social health. I am Dr. Arliss Wood with Dr. Suzanne Wood, who now introduces the program.
As we begin Black History Month, I realize today's topic is a very personal one with me. I remember an event from the time our first daughter was in kindergarten. We had our neighbors over for dinner with their daughter of the same age. We were shocked when they began decrying that the public schools had been integrated, and how dreadful it was. We protested rather strongly. The father said, "We felt that way only because our child was in a private school." He then called our little daughter over from the other room and asked her pointedly, "Do you have any Black friends at school?" She thought about it for a bit, looked up at him and said, "No," and scampered off. He was triumphant until I explained to him her very best and dearest friend at school was quite Black. That lovely Black child is still a dear friend and is currently a practicing attorney in New York City today. And so we begin our program hoping to be thoughtful about every perspective, but particularly we want to say that Black History Month is an annual celebration of achievements by African Americans and a time for recognizing their central role in U.S. history. So to begin to introduce today's guest, we have another story from not very long ago. This is one of my favorite stories of all time. It's a story about some buffaloes and a new young reporter in Bozeman. Welcome, Dionne Broxton. Thanks for coming back to visit.
Thank you for having me on.
And we'd love to hear you tell us one more time about that buffalo event that went national and international. Tell us what happened.
For the 1,000,000th and 31st time.
I'm sorry, but you have to.
I remember it vividly because I think Yellowstone National Park is a great park, but it can be troublesome during the summertime when there are so many visitors. So I remember that day the park had announced that it would be closed for the pandemic. And I remember my news director telling me that I had to go cover the story. And I was very frustrated because it's an hour and 15 minutes to drive from Bozeman to Yellowstone on a good day. And then an hour and 15 back. So I didn't want to spend 2.5 hours on the road. But I remember on my way to the park, I had set up an interview with the superintendent and I pulled over in Gardner, Montana to do a quick phone interview. And then I went into the park after the interview and I remember seeing so many bison. And normally there are a good number of people around, so the animals usually keep their distance. But because the park was closed for the pandemic, I mean, it had to be about 50 or 60 bison in my view, just at the north entrance in Gardner. And I remember setting my camera up, you know, recording my stuff for the story for that night. And I saw, I think it was 5 or 6 bison kind of making their way towards me, but I felt confident enough that I could shoot my stand up and be done by the time they came over to me. And I kept stumbling and messing up. And as I wasted time, they made their way to me. Now, I don't think they were coming to attack me, but I was just in their path. And as you could see in the video, they got kind of too close for comfort, and I decided to make an exit stage right. Or stage left, if you're looking at it as a viewer.
Yes.
And that got on the internet, and how many replies or how many views did that get?
I still have the video on my Twitter. I want to say 15 million. Maybe I'm wrong, but I haven't checked in a couple of, it might have been maybe like a year or two since I've looked.
What was the famous phrase that you said?
I think I said, oh no, I'm not messing with you.
And you weren't realizing all of this was caught on camera as you were rushing to take things down.
And I've told this story many times. In Montana, you know, it's a starter market. It's a small market. So a lot of the reporters, I'm kind of embarrassed about this now, being like a really serious reporter in St. Louis. But back then, we kind of joked around a lot because it was one of those starter markets where we didn't feel the pressure as much as you do in a bigger market. So we would post bloopers all the time. And not just me, but my coworkers and my friend at other TV station, we would post bloopers all the time. So in my mind, it was just going to be another blooper that I posted on Twitter. And I had no idea it would go viral.
Okay. So you escaped from the Buffalo. So tell us what happened next. Who all contacted you? What all did you do?
And I don't think a lot of people know this, but Deion Sanders didn't contact me, but he was the one, in my opinion, who made the video go viral. I mean, I think it's a funny video, but I distinctly remember him sharing the video and calling me his namesake. And I think at the time, Deion Sanders had 1 million followers. I'm sure he has more followers now since becoming the coach of Colorado. But I think he played a vital part in helping the video go viral. But there were like local ESPN radio stations, the Baltimore Sun, which is the newspaper in Baltimore, the Huffington Post, I think I did an interview with, the Guardian, and in Europe I did an interview with. I mean, I've lost count. I think the majority were like small local places, kind of hoping to just get me. But, you know, I'm such an advocate of journalism. I tried my best to not turn anyone down. So if I didn't interview with someone, I'm sorry. It was very overwhelming at the time, but I remember just seeing it everywhere. And you know, when there were accidents or, you know, encounters with animals and tourists after that video, a lot of the national news outlets would show my video. I remember the Today Show. I think someone got hurt or someone was caught on camera interacting with a bison. And I remember just, I was in Iowa at the time, but, you know, I'm just casually watching the Today Show and the story comes on and they use a clip from me. And I just thought, like, will this ever end?
That's so amazing. Wow. And you put Bozeman on that particular map. That was quite an event. And, you know, not all moments as a reporter are as frightening or as special as that one. We really have loved following your career, and you started here in Bozeman, basically. Tell us a little bit about what it's like becoming a reporter, what your preparation is, and some of the difficulties and stresses of being a reporter.
Well, I grew up in Baltimore, which is a predominantly Black city. So I was used to seeing stories about crime and corruption and things like that versus in Montana. You know, it's a lot about wildlife, the outdoors. So that was a big adjustment for me. But, you know, growing up in a place like Baltimore, I had a very thick Baltimore accent and I had to work on that. So I worked with a speech pathologist in Silver Spring, Maryland, just outside of D.C. for about 3 months to work on my accent so I can get a job in a place like Montana, because I had to have applied to maybe 4 or 5 dozen places to get a TV job, but I would get no calls back, no emails. And I was close to getting one in Gainesville, Florida, but the news director told me that my accent was too strong and I would have to work on it if he hired me. Ultimately, he didn't hire me, but you know, I wasn't someone who felt sorry for myself. It's just, okay, keep working, you know, find another avenue to get to what you want. So I worked behind the scenes in Baltimore as an assignment editor and a digital content producer. But during my time, I was also shadowing reporters and getting advice and feedback on how to become an on-air reporter. And, you know, Suzanne, being a speech pathologist yourself, you helped me a lot with grandiose was the word you would always use. You know, I kind of got to a foundational level of, you know, good standard English. But the next goal for me was to reach this grandiose level of speaking to make me more attractive to other employers and news outlets in larger markets. So you definitely helped me with that. But everything was just different. You know, I had to speak differently. I was around people who didn't look like me. I went to a predominantly white high school and I went to a predominantly black elementary and middle school. So I was used, and I went to a predominantly white college. So I was used to being around like white people, but Montana was like a completely different experience because people on the, you know, and it's also regional, it's regional, right? People [S2] Yeah. [S1] On the East Coast are a lot different from people in Montana. When I would meet people in Montana, they would say that, you know, I don't own a TV. I moved here to be in the outdoors and to hike and to ski and snowboard. So that was just such a culture shock for me. But at the end of the day, I think I still learned that, you know, people all want the same things. Like I work here in St. Louis now, and, you know, crime is a big part of the city's identity, but people want to live in a safe environment. And the way that I connect the dots are Montana and Bozeman is a safe environment and people move there to be in a safe environment. So I have that contrast of interviewing people who know what a safe environment feels like and then people who want to get to a safe environment. And me growing up in Baltimore, I've kind of always been on guard my entire life because of the crime in Baltimore. But going to Bozeman was the first time in my life where I truly felt safe and I wasn't looking over my shoulder and I wasn't paranoid about being outside. So I always explain to people that I think Montana, they called it what, the last America's best kept secret or the last best place in America, something like that.
Yes.
And mm-hmm. I think it truly is. The diversity is lacking. You know, the truth is in America, some people need the diversity to feel comfortable. But, you know, if you're a white person in America, you may not need diversity to feel comfortable in a place like Montana. For me, you know, it was safe, but I still didn't feel 100% comfortable because I didn't have people around who looked like me and people who I could relate to that much. Because at the end of the day, if you can meet people and talk to people who have similar experiences as you, it makes you feel more comfortable. But I never regret the time I spent in Montana. I think it was one of the most challenging times of my life. One, dealing with a new job that I've never done before, you know, on TV, making mistakes on TV. And then two, learning about a different culture and trying to fit in or assimilate to some point, but still not lose myself in that culture.
Exactly. And when we reflect that Montana has a 2% population of persons of color, you really were in a different setting altogether, weren't you, Dion?
Yes. And people will always ask me about that. How does someone from Baltimore go to a place like Montana? And I'll always say that beggars can't be choosers. When you're trying to get your first job in news, you don't really have too many options. I did have options. My two other options were Macon, Georgia. I never got the job offer, but I was in the process of interviewing. And I decided to go to Montana because that job was guaranteed and the Macon, Georgia job wasn't guaranteed. And I also got an offer from Peoria, Illinois. And I did some research and I just thought, yeah, I think I'd rather see mountains than old industrial buildings.
Yes, we're so glad you did. And you were just an excellent reporter. We wonder, we know that certain professions bring a real high level of stress. For instance, police officers who deal with crime and those sorts of things. Even veterinarians who deal with sick and ailing and dying animals, that there's a high level of stress involved. I don't think most people realize some of the stresses involved with just being a reporter, with having deadlines, with covering stories that are very difficult and continuously being confronted with perhaps very negative situations. Tell us how you feel about that, Dion.
Oh, I think your environment dictates how you can deal with stresses in life. Growing up in Baltimore, you know, I would say I had a pretty good childhood. You know, I saw, you know, the things that Baltimore are known for, you know, drug use, you know, crime. I've seen those things, but I think my parents did a good job of, you know, keeping me out of that lifestyle and trying to put me in positive places. But I'm aware of it. And I think when you grow up in a community like that, it prepares you for this difficult life. It's what, I mean, and you hear this all the time, being Black, right? Being Black in America isn't as easy as being a white person in America. So I think we're already programmed to be tough, you know, and but you still don't know what you don't know. So coming to Montana, the deadlines were an issue sometimes. You know, not being able to relate to some of the stories were issues. But after a while, it became easy and it wasn't as fulfilling for me anymore. And then so, you know, I moved on to Iowa and that wasn't fulfilling for me. And now I live in a place like St. Louis where I feel closer to the stories I cover because there is a big Black population here. And you just can't help but feel connections to what you understand and what you know. But with that comes greater stresses because, you know, the Black population, we know don't make as much money as the white population. So they don't have access to lawyers and resources and people who can help them. So they're only avenue to get some sort of justice is to reach out to a local news reporter. So like right now my life is probably the most stressed I've ever been in my life because every day I constantly have people constantly reaching out to me and you don't want to ignore them, but you know, I'm trying not to lose my sanity because you want to help. You know, I'm an idealist. I do believe that my storytelling can make the world a better place. But man, it's a lot of stress that's on you, and you don't want to let people down. So I would say in the beginning, as a journalist, the stress of meeting deadlines, trying to please bosses, that's very stressful. But that for me, that stress has evolved into not letting community members down, and knowing how much they rely on me because they have no other resources to seek justice. And I'm not saying these people are scotch clean and don't have, you know, bad backgrounds, but I think I owe it to them to at least look into their stories and reach out to people in power to see if I can come to some sort of resolution. And for me, that's the biggest stress on my life right now is I'm having a hard time answering everybody. And I think it's a result of the reporting that people see and they feel like they can trust me and come to me with their issues, but I don't think there are enough of me's, enough of Dion's out there because, you know, if you grow up in an affluent community, you may not feel a connection to these stories, to people who live in poor neighborhoods. And then if you do have someone reach out to you and you come from an affluent background, they may not feel like you portray the story accurately enough. So they, you know, I can relate to these people because I've once lived in those communities filled with crime and drug use and corruption. So, is this a lot to tackle? And I don't think it's getting any easier because as we watch the news, you know, inflation is, you know, the economy is rebounding, but people are still feeling inflation. And I remember with COVID, you know, the saying in the Black community is if white America has the cold, then Black America has the flu. And with COVID, we saw that minorities were disproportionately impacted by COVID. And I believe that's the case for anything. With inflation, I feel like Black people are disproportionately impacted by things like that. So I think there's a need for, you know, being Black History Month, I think there's a need for Black journalists, but Black journalists who can relate to people who need the most help. And I think that's one of the tenets and foundations of journalism. I believe all people should seek justice and get help. But I think Gandhi and Martin Luther King, and I think they even talk about it in the Bible, where you try to help the people who could see the greatest impact. You know, we talk about equality and equity. Sometimes in life, you know, some people just need a little bit more assistance to lift themselves up by the bootstraps. And this is the stuff that's constantly going through my mind as a journalist. How can I be of use to society?
You know, you made a connection that I hadn't thought of quite as clearly until now. I do a lot of examinations as a psychologist for veterans, and there's a PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, is one of the diagnoses that is made most often for the VA of the people that I see. And my son-in-law, who is an emergency room physician, pointed out with the all of the first responders, those who work in emergency rooms and those who do the ambulances and the first line of care, they also suffer PTSD. I think I would add your category of news reporter. You could easily develop that because you are, in a sense, a first responder. Do you think of yourself like that?
Yes. I remember reading an article, I want to say 2 years ago, that talked about the trauma that journalists experience. And I always say this, the trauma of a family, the trauma that a family experiences when it comes to losing a loved one, when it comes to gun violence, a car accident, or whatever, I will never feel as bad as they feel, but I always take a piece of that with me. And for every crime, every tragedy that you cover, you take a piece of that trauma with you. And, you know, I grew up in Baltimore. I was exposed to the trauma. But I went to Montana. I was in Montana for 2 years. I was in Iowa for 16 and a half months. You know, I was in pretty safe places where I wasn't covering that much tragedy. You know, it might be like a snowstorm or a car accident or a weather event where someone might die, but not the tragedy of someone, you know, deliberately picking up a gun and shooting and killing someone. So I remember it was a Saturday night. It was one of my first weekends in St. Louis. I was working, and I think it was a two-year-old child. A two-year-old child picked up his father's gun and accidentally shot and killed his father. And, you know, we responded to the scene, and I wasn't used to being at scenes like this. I am now, for being here for nearly 2.5 years. But I remember the ambulance pulling up. And, you know, normally if someone has a chance of being saved, they would put them in the ambulance and the ambulance will take off right away. I remember the ambulance pulling up and not leaving. And then the medical examiner showed up and I'm just like, yep, the father has died. And the family, they're all like arriving to the scene. This is probably around 10 o'clock, 9:30 at night. And you see the detectives come out of the house. And you see, like, the family members are, like, on edge. And you know it's going to be – you know the detective is reporting bad news. And the detective came over to talk to the family. And next thing I know, you hear people just screaming. There was one woman who – I believe it was the victim's sister. She just collapsed to the ground. And she said, my brother's dead. It was something along those lines. she just kept screaming, "My brother's dead, my brother's dead." And then the mother of the child, if I'm not mistaken, the mother of the victim who was killed, she just ran. She was just like running in circles because I think it was just I think she was in shock and she didn't know what to do. She just started just running in circles hysterically. And the men there were trying to like console them. And I remember, and this is where the friction with the Black community and the police department remains. I remember the police officers trying to console everyone. And the Black men were very combative with the police officers. And I never forgot that, because even in the midst of such tragedy, that distrust between the Black community and the police officers still existed. And for me, it was just a lot for me to like take in all at once. And I remember when the detectives and the police officers told the family that the guy was dead, you know, I can't hear any of this, but I'm just guessing what was said. I don't think it's hard to figure out what was said. And I heard the screaming and I saw the woman running. And I remember the photographer who I was with, I think he's been in this market for like 20 something years. And he saw the toll it took on me, because he looked at me and I just looked away because I couldn't watch this family cry. But then I saw this happen 10, 15, 20, 30 more times since I've been here in St. Louis. So I'm used to it now, but at first it was trauma that I didn't know how to deal with, but now I look at it as energy to compel me to make the world a better place. I know it sounds kind of naive. I know it sounds idealistic, but you know, that trauma I felt seeing the family suffer from a loved one motivated me to like, man, I if I can use my role as a journalist to prevent this from happening, I want to do that. So I think there's a silver lining to most things. And, you know, I think a lot of great things come out of bad things. I think of like Nat Turner with the slave rebellion. That was an awful thing that happened. But, you know, if you frustrate a group of people enough, they will revolt. You know, Martin Luther King was assassinated, but I think it still galvanized the Black community to make things different. You know, we saw the Civil Rights Acts of 1964 and 1965. And unfortunately, it takes great things, good or bad, to happen to see change. This country was born from a revolution, you know, the Civil War. We see results out of great tragedies. We see all these school shootings, and that has compelled some lawmakers to, you know, strengthen gun laws. You know, it's unfortunate, but I think in America, we are a very reactive society. And I think traumatic events across all professions is what leads to change.
And we couldn't agree more that these events stimulate other events. I mean, when you read statistics like that Black women are three times more likely to die from pregnancy-related causes than white, you have to wonder, where does it all begin? And I know one Canadian psychologist who sent out his information was stating that that was a reason you could say that Black people are inferior, because they have higher medical problems and death rates, which was really, this was a turnaround of the truth, but it allowed racism to flourish among his group. So we have some past history of medical and science with people who were promoting theories that are unlikely. This was long ago, but still currently we're seeing a change. And have you felt like there's been an increase currently and over the last few years in racism, Dion?
Oh, that's a really good question. The response that I hear a lot, I think of The response I hear a lot is racism looks different now. Does it still exist? I'm positive it still exists. I think it just takes different forms and shapes. I think it's not as overt as it was back in the 60s when you see, you know, dogs being sicked on people and water hoses. I think it just looks differently now. And I'm gonna give an example. I don't want to accuse a government entity of racism. I mean, I think if you do some research and some investigating, you can come to a conclusion if you believe something is racism or not. But I recently did a story on a county that received American Rescue Plan funding. And one of the cities within the county has had flooding issues. The city has been flooding for decades. A recent study was done by Washington University professors, and they found that the residents had a higher level of H. pylori, which is a bacteria. The residents had a higher level of a certain bacteria in their stool samples, and they believe that's from the flooding, because these researchers have studied, you know, third world countries without proper sewer systems and water systems. And they said that the findings were very similar to people who live in a third world country. So, you know, these residents, they have lawyers, they've filed lawsuits. And the residents recently filed a complaint to the federal government saying that the county in which they live in didn't allocate any of the American Rescue Plan funding to the city. And, you know, they allege racism. You know, they use the lawsuits or the complaint said they use this money to fund more affluent communities. Now, I'm not calling it racism. I'm going to remain an unbiased journalist. But to some people, this is what racism looks like, right? You have the ability to alleviate, because this is public money, right? You pick and you vote and you decide on where this money should go. And this money didn't go to this community. The community received $800,000 to repair a water tanker, like the big, you know, you roll into a city, you see the big tanker, the big water tank with the city's name on it. They received $800,000 to fix that water tank. But the county had $50 million to fix the issues of the county, and only less than a 50th of that was dedicated to that city, and it doesn't solve the root problem. This is what is laid out in that complaint. So to some people, this is what the new racism looked like, you know, not allocating funding to certain communities. You know, every person has the right to defend themselves, but I'm just telling this story through the eyes of the people who believe they're oppressed and suffer from this. So when you hear doctors justify black women or black people being inferior because of all the diseases and stuff, that's likely a result of the lack of funding and resources put in these communities for the people to go get better. And even if they do have some of these resources in their communities, it may not be enough, you know? Because if they have higher rates of sicknesses, you know, more resources are needed, you know, so that's to what some people, what racism now looks like.
The root problem, the truth of it, needs to be exposed. In other words, that this is not about what you're seeing, like the money being given to affluent communities. It's about that we are actually, yes, we're making political and other even environmental decisions that could be deemed highly racist.
Exactly. I mean, we see it with housing, right? There were a number of stories that came out the last few years where if a black person would be in their house when it's being appraised, it would be appraised for a lower amount. But then when they would have a white person come and stand in for them, it would be appraised for a higher amount. I know these companies defended their decisions, but it begs the question, you know, is there an underlying discrimination or racism where you believe that a black person can't, you know, own a house of a certain quality? You know, this might be unconscious. And I think this is why it's important to have these people in rooms to address this, because I can understand if you grew up in an all white community and you were never really exposed to things like this. But I think in this day and age, you can't plead ignorance anymore with so much technology and so much media out there to educate yourself. So I still think people need to be in those rooms to at least raise the question. I'm not saying that, you know, black people deserve to get everything and you should always give them what they ask for. I just think you should hear what your constituents are telling you and just be cognizant of it and how things might appear. And if you continue to make the same decisions, be prepared to explain that decision so you're not being viewed as racist or not being transparent with that community. Because I think one thing about people, Malcolm X said it, I think it was in his speech, The Ballot or the Bullet, I believe it was that speech, where he says, I'd rather deal with the wolf than the fox, because the fox will sneak up from behind you and bite you from behind, but the wolf will bite you in your face. So if, you know, you want to keep, you know, allocating funds or doing things that may not necessarily benefit a group of minorities, be ready to explain that. And then, you know, that group of people will take it. They'd rather take that, in my opinion, than to be lied to and to make them believe that you're considering them when in truth you may not just care, you may not care about what they're going through.
And we should remember that in the aftermath of the Second World War, two conferences of internationally recognized scientists held by the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, which we call UNESCO, issued statements about race. Although there were some slight differences in their observations, both groups agreed that equality as an ethical principle concerning the rights to be enjoyed by all members of society was not predicated on any scientific conclusion about racial characteristics, and this position should still inform our thinking about race and science. We are all perfectly equal, and we all deserve the treatment of equality.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a good saying, or a good observation.
I'm wondering, Dion, what do you think so much resistance in recent times, and maybe it's not recent, but at least we're seeing it recently, the DEI programs, diversity, equity, and inclusion, critical race theory, using the term woke to describe it. Is part of me says that's always been there, but there's more permission given because of certain leadership issues in politics that have given permission for that those things to be said. Do you think it's new? Or do you think, why is the current wave so acute?
Let's start with woke.
Okay.
So I think woke has been weaponized for conservatives to bash liberal policies, which I don't agree with, because the roots of woke were found, I believe, in the 1930s, where it was a term used amongst black people where they would educate each other about the societal, racial, you know, things going on around them. It basically means be aware of what's going on around you to protect yourself. And that's where the term, you know, woke comes, because if you're asleep, you don't know what's going on around you. But if you're awake, you know what's going on around you. So I think of the movie The Green Book with Mahershala Ali. And The Green Book was a book where black people can travel to places where they can be safe and not get in trouble and, you know, not be subjected to racism. That's what woke is being aware. I think it's been transformed and taken to mean like woke means, you know, reparations and this and that. And I think that's not accurate whatsoever. So it's just been weaponized. But when it comes to DEI, I actually just watched CBS Mornings, the national morning show, where they were speaking to a founder of an organization that gives out money to minorities, I believe. I caught kind of the back end of it, but she explained that in programs where race is considered, the disparities, like the results of, you know, minorities being admitted to programs and the long-term effects after these programs, it shows that the disparities between white and black people and whites and minorities really close, because you're consciously thinking, you know what? You're thinking about equity. You know, this person needs a little bit more just to get to the same playing field. And it's, I think you ignore that when you take away DEI, you know, I think you have to consider people's backgrounds. And I know when the Supreme Court ruled against DEI, you know, when it comes to college-based admissions, a lot of people were worried, and people are trying to figure out, how do you navigate this now? Because a part of the college admission process, they ask you, you know, what was it like growing up? What factors have shaped you in your life? And we know in America, black people don't make as much money. And when you don't make as much money, you tend to live in poorer communities. So your race kind of shapes who you are. I remember a TV station in Seattle. This was post George Floyd. They were asking random people on the street, do you ever think about race? And all the minorities who they stopped, I think this won a bunch of awards. All the minorities who they stopped said yes, they thought about race. And they stopped white people and they said, no, I don't really think about my race that much. So it shows you how much we think about it, you know. But I know people argue that we're teaching people to think about race when you have all this, you know, diversity, inclusion and equity. You're forcing people to think they're inferior. You're forcing white people to think they're their oppressor. I think it's just history. I think you have to teach history to avoid repeating it. I went to Germany last year for a fellowship, and Germany has totally embraced educating their population about the Holocaust. There's no questions about it. If you deny the Holocaust in Germany, it's a crime. You can't, you know, show stuff from Hitler, you can go to jail for it. And they've really embraced this, we will never let the Holocaust happen ever again. Versus hearing it, so we call it, I think Germany calls the Holocaust their original sin, I believe, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
And I said the original sin for America is slavery. And, you know, all these years later, slavery was abolished in 1863, I believe. But then on June 19th, 1865, the last slaves in Galveston, Texas, learned about they were free, about the Emancipation Proclamation. So since 1865, until 2024, we still are having trouble dealing with our original sin. Now, I know people get upset when they say, oh, you can't blame slavery for the economic conditions of black people today. I disagree with that. You know, when you're taken from your home country, you're not given anything, you're forced to work in fields. And then when you're freed, you do the same kind of work for a nickel. When your counterpart can get a quarter for doing something else, that's where you don't have the opportunity, or the opportunity to build generational wealth is really far behind. And we all know if your family has been free for 10 generations, the likelihood of you increasing generational wealth will increase versus I'm probably what, fifth or sixth generation from my family. And I'm the one who's creating that generational wealth. My family hasn't created that generational wealth because my grandmother grew up in South Carolina, where the only thing she could do in rural South Carolina was pick cotton and make money for the family. And, you know, and we see it here in America, right? you tend to hire minorities for lower wages because the belief is minorities will work for lower wages than what some white people will work for. So I think it's a part of the economic systems where, you know, especially with Mexicans, right, coming from across the border, we always hear about illegal immigration because the Mexicans, they're so desperate to flee the crime and the stuff they're seeing in their home country to work here for less money. That's why you hear about illegal immigrants making up a big part of the U.S. economy because you can pay them less to do things. So I think this, the same was said for America back in the 18 and 1900s, where you could pay black people a lot less money to do work. East St. Louis, which is across the river from me and here in St. Louis, they had a race riot in 1917, if I'm not mistaken. And it was because one of the companies in East St. Louis, the white workers went on strike. And when the white workers went on strike, the companies hired black people to do it for less work. And that's what caused the race riots, is that the black people and white people fought because the white workers were so upset that they were going to lose their jobs because the black people were willing to do it for less. And I think, you know, that's what our society has always been founded on. That's what capitalism is, right? How can you make the most money while paying people the least amount? And in this country, we know that minorities make a lot less than white people. So I think that's why DEI is so important. So you can make those connections to how we end up in the society that we're seeing now, which gives you more awareness when it comes to hiring people and wanting to learn the perspectives of people. Because if, you know, I think it was Juilliard or some of those, you know, performance schools where they were revamping what classics are, the classics, you know, in literature, you know, Shakespeare, Beethoven, these were always considered the classics. But, you know, as a black person, if your family didn't listen to that, you may not consider that as the classics, you know. So what you're being judged on, you know, if you want to apply to Juilliard, if you want to apply to Harvard and be a part of their literature program, what the person judging you consider as a classic might not be what you consider as a classic. So then you're already at a disadvantage where, you know, to me, I like Marvin Gaye, I like Scott Joplin, where that person can't relate to you. There's a disconnect, you know? So then you might not be, oh, he's not prepared for this program. You know, I think that's why DEI is so important, so we can make a level playing field for everybody, so everyone can live the American dream, not just a certain group of people.
I couldn't agree more, Dion. And one of the ways that people defend getting rid of DEI is that, well, it's already served its purpose, and we've made all this progress, and everything is fine. We had Iho Pomeroy, a beloved community member on the show, who is of Asian culture and heritage, and also a member of our city council.
I've been a visitor when I was in Bozeman.
And Iho related on the show that people painted all over her van when she first came here slurs of the Asian heritage. But so that was long ago when she first came. But I want to point out that in yesterday's newspaper, Thursday, February 1st, in the police reports, it states there were graffiti depictions of swastikas and cuss words painted on signs around town in Bozeman. So I realize this is probably one or two or a few individuals who did this, but this is reminiscent of some of the reasons why we want our communities to be stable, equal, and fair. So what you're saying has a lot of resonance, Dion.
I think it's the pendulum, though. I know immigration is a big issue around the country right now. Germany, a lot of the countries in Europe are dealing with immigration. So you're seeing a lot of xenophobia because, you know, these countries, especially the leaders of these countries, they want people who can contribute to their working class, not people who will use the benefits, the social benefits or the social services of their countries. But I think this is why it's important for world leaders to communicate with each other to make the places better, because if the U.S. can better communicate with Mexico and try to get rid of the crime and the corruption that's going on there, it will lead to not as many people wanting to cross the border. The same for Germany and for, you know, Russia is trying to take Ukraine back. You know, if we can work with these countries, it will limit the mass immigration that we see. I mean, we see it right now with the Middle East. A lot of people in the Middle East are fleeing to different places. And a lot of these, you know, affluent countries are worried about taking in so many people and not being able to take care of their own people. And, you know, so I think this is why it's important to, one, educate about where people are coming from, because you can criticize where these people are coming from, but I'm pretty sure if you were in the same boat and where you lived and people were bombing, empathy is, I think, is what we need. And I'm not saying we should just open our borders and accept everyone, but I think we got to play an important role of trying to make the places where these people live better so we don't have these immigration problems. I think leaders are trying to do this, but it's very hard. But
I wanted to point out, we had the statewide head of the Montana IRC, the International Rescue Committee, on, and he talked about immigrants from Ukraine and many other places coming here. But he pointed out a national statistic that over 70% of new businesses in the United States of America over the last 20 years were started by either new immigrants or children of immigrants, so that an influx of people has had a very positive impact in general on the United States.
But that's not the everyone no. wants Mexican everyone wants Mexican food, but they don't want the Mexicans, you know? Is this
and who comes and gives us so many gifts?
So it's troubling to hear that, but people choose to ignore that. But I think that's what politicians do, right? They play on fear and they want to hold on to, and I don't think there's nothing wrong with holding on to your values, right? This is going on in Germany right now, where they're seeing a lot of immigrants come there, and people say, we don't want to lose our German culture. And Americans say, we don't want to lose our American culture. But what about the Native Americans when they lost their culture? You know, I think we all, I don't know this, but I like to think we all can coexist, because we love Mexican food. We love all different kinds of foods. So we got to accept the people who bring their foods here and coexist with them, because, you know, you don't just want Americanized Panda Express. You want the authentic experience. There's a ramen place here in I like American ramen that's, you know, full of salt and easy to make. But I had authentic ramen down the street from where I live, and it's really good. And I'm appreciative for that community for coming here and for, you know, I mean, not just food, but just, I think there's so much we can learn about other cultures.
I need to point out right there before we move from food that we talked about Iho Pomeroy, and she has brought us authentic food from Korea and has just recently been announced on the front pages of the Bozeman paper that she's up for a national James Beard Award for authentic cuisine from native Korea. She makes kimchi for the supermarket. She's provided so much for our community. And so there's one beautiful example of what you're saying, Dion.
Yeah, I think it feels like we just pick the bad things about communities and point them out, because we don't, I think this is what politicians do, right? They stoke fear to get elected. So I think of, you know, the Japanese restaurants, right? In Japan, you don't tip, and they're very respectful. They're very, have very well mannered. And that's something we can learn here in America, is how to be nice and well-mannered to each other, you know?
I couldn't agree more.
I wanted to point something out about the myth about that one race is superior to another, and intelligence tests used to show the difference. Well, I once had a grant to invite speakers to a small northeastern Oklahoma rural area mental health clinic, and we found a lady from St. Louis University in your area, and she had put together, she's a lady of color, a psychologist, and she put together a test based on the culture of the inner city black people in St. Louis and around the country, and you would be very interested in the name of it. It's called the Black Intelligence Test of Cultural Homogeneity. Now, the abbreviation is that is the bitch. And and she made a very interesting point with that in her publications. White people taking that failed it, black people passed it, whereby the opposite on the ones put together in the white culture, which many of them were for years and years until they were appropriately sorted out to be a random sample of the whole population, whereby there is no difference. We're all people. But if you want to talk to anybody, if they want to take the bitch, well, you know where to get it. So,
yeah, I think that's one of the reasons why we've been seeing colleges not take standardized or taking standardized testing out of the admissions process, because, you know, those, and I get it, right? We want to have a well-educated community, but, you know, we've known this for a long time that black reading scores tend to be lower and black testing scores tend to be lower. And I'm not saying you lower the bar for students because based on race, but I've had teachers tell me this where the standardized testing is geared to kids who have extracurricular activities, who get the extra tutoring, who grow up in these affluent communities. So the belief is, how can we make this equitable, right? Because if you live in a household where proper grammar isn't used, you're already going to be behind eight ball. And I know people get frustrated where they say, man, you've given so many crutches to these black people. And this is the reality of the communities that we live in, you know, where the school, the classrooms are overcrowded, you know, the books are old, you know. I know that politicians have been allocating money, but it's just, you know, it's not just the school, it's the crime in your communities, it's the broken families, it's all piece of a puzzle. And when half the puzzle pieces are missing, some people just need a lot more puzzle pieces than others.
And, you know, that's very research-based. There's study after study to underline what you just said.
Dion, we have about 1 minute. Could you tell us why we should recognize Black History Month in 30 to 45 seconds?
I believe we should acknowledge Black History Month because Black history just isn't Black history. It's American history. And I think for far too long, history books have been written by white people and not given a black perspective. So I think Black History Month has given us the black perspective of accomplishments that black people have made to American history, because American history involves a lot more than just white people, black people. It involves a lot of different groups.
Dion Broxton, thank you so much. Investigative reporter, reporter in the St. Louis area, friend, thank you so much. Extremely well-presented program today by you. Thank you. We'd like to tell the audience here in Gallatin Valley that you can hear this program on 95.9 KGVM, as you're listening to now, or go to kgvm.org. And please turn it again. Thank you, Dion.
Thank you.